Not quite. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. What should children read? The terrain opened with that question might not be as conflict-ridden as asking about sex, politics, or religion at a family get-together. But then again, many of us have very strong feelings about children's books. According to our guest this afternoon, that's been the case in America from the get-go for some 300 years now. Our guest this afternoon is Leonard Marcus. He is the author most recently of Minders of Make-Believe, Idealists, Entrepreneurs, and the Shaping of American Children's Literature. At the very outset of the book, he lists those who have played a role in shaping children's literature. They are publishers, religious and moral leaders, literary critics, educators, librarians, booksellers, psychologists, parents, and yes, children. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments. Your thoughts about children's literature are invited. What should children read? Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Leonard Marcus is a leading historian and critic in the field of American children's literature. He's a frequent contributor to the New York Times Book Review, the Washington Post Book World, Horn Book, Publishers Weekly, and Parenting Magazine, where he's a contributing editor. He is the author of 7 books. His latest, Minders of Make-Believe, is published by Houghton Mifflin. And again, the phone number's 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Hope you'll join our discussion this afternoon. Leonard Marcus, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm very happy to be with you.
It's interesting to think of children's literature as having a history. You say other than children's librarians, there wasn't much attention paid to this history until relatively recently. Why not?
Well, I think that most of us experience children's books at bedtime or when we're young on rainy days. And there's so much in the foreground of our private lives that we don't step back from it and think of children's books as a kind of literature that reflects the hopes and dreams of each generation.
Why do you think it is, then, that it's received more attention over the last 20, 30 years?
I think it probably has to do with the fact that the baby boom generation, of which I'm a member, came of age. And that time after the Depression and World War II, the parents of that era were very focused on giving their children better lives. There was an explosion of interest in children's books and toys and children's television, everything to do with what we would call the culture of childhood. And so I think that led some of those children of my generation who then grew up and went to college in greater numbers than any American generation had before to sort of reflect on those childhood experiences, including from the point of view of literature and history.
Now, when you use the term children's literature, what do you include?
Well, it's a good question because it really covers many different genres, starting these days with board books, which are designed for babies to not only listen to and look at, but also bite and tug at. They have a sort of hard high destruction threshold.
Yeah, and that's okay.
And that in itself shows you something about the insight that is now being brought to bear in the making of children's books, because people at a certain time began paying attention to, to what small children are really like, and so what kind of books would be appropriate for them, not very expensive books printed on fancy paper. But to get back to your question, so that represents one extreme, but then there are picture books which tell full-fledged stories, which are for children who have longer attention spans. Then you get into early readers like The Cat in the Hat and Little Bear by Elsa Minerick, which are designed for children who are just able to read on their own and give them the confidence that they can get to the end of a story without help from anybody else. Then you get into things that approach what we would call the equivalent of an adult novel, and then on into the young adult range of writing, which is very hard-hitting and hard-edged and about all the things that teenagers are, concerned, worried, and curious about.
Yeah. When you look at American children's literature from a period of time, are you able to gain insights into that time, into that history?
Oh, I think so. For instance, the Little House books by Laura Ingalls Wilder began appearing in the 1930s. And that, of course, was the time of the Depression. And I think the books were embraced by Americans in the 30s and 40s, in part because they saw in those stories of survival on the prairie, in what for many people was the generation of their grandparents' time, a kind of metaphor for their own lives, and people drew hope from that. So that would be one example. When you look at Where the Wild Things Are by Marie Sendak, which came out in the 60s, you're looking at the first children's book for a younger child in which a child gets really angry at his mother. Mm-hmm. And what you're seeing, really, behind the scenes is the belated impact of Freud and all of the insight into the emotional lives of children finally making its way into a kind of literature that had always been very overly protective of children, especially the younger ones, and afraid to show those darker emotions that all of us, in fact, have.
Yeah. One of the really interesting periods that you cover in the book is children's literature during and after the Civil War. What a fascinating time.
Oh, yeah, I certainly found it to be so. I called that chapter Wonder in the Wake of War. And the meaning of that is it was only up until the Civil War, a lot of what was written for children was morally prescriptive. There was the tone, the attitude that was taken was that we, the adults, know what's good and what's not good, and we can give you children a story which will present an example to follow and another example perhaps of a bad child who should not be befriended or looked up to in any way. It was very clear. After the Civil War, you start to see a lot less of that. And one can surmise, I think fairly, that Americans were so shaken by the violence and destruction of that war, which touched probably most families in America one way or another, just the sheer horror of it, that I think it shook people's sense of moral certitude. And one consequence of that was that they became more open to fiction, to stories that are a little bit more morally ambiguous, which acknowledge more about the nuances of human behavior and human motivation.
Yeah. And also apparently some people thought that this was a time when there was a growing feeling of rebellion on the part of children.
Well, in some ways, what happens in the family is a microcosm of what happens in society. And there were writers at that time who were saying, now that we've conquered the rebels, this is a northern writer speaking about the South, how are we going to conquer the young rebels in our own households? And they saw fiction for children as a way of giving kids a chance to act out their rebellious feelings vicariously so they'd be less inclined to do it in actual life.
Interesting. When did the characters Huck Finn
Tom Sawyer.
Tom Sawyer, thank you.
Yeah, sure.
When did they appear, and what was the situation when they appeared, and how were they viewed at the time?
Well, it's very much what we've just been talking about. 1870s and 80s. And Mark Twain was perhaps the preeminent writer of stories about about good, bad boys, boys who are given to mischief, to doing the thing their parents tell them not to do, to running away from home, to playing pranks. In the case of Huck, it's a much more serious story as it unfolds. But this was very much that impulse to get away from rigid moralization. In fact, Huckleberry Finn is full of satire directed against the people who are so sure of themselves morally. In that book, they always turn out to be hypocrites or frauds or both.
Yeah, and they're these are books that can be read and enjoyed by adults.
And interestingly, Mark Twain was unsure in a way who he was writing for. When he finished Tom Sawyer, which was the first of those two books, he told his wife that he'd just written the great American novel, and she read it and said, "No, I think you've written a very good book for boys." And then when he set out to write the sequel, he thought that he was writing another great book for boys, or hoped it would be great. But then it took this turn toward a deep reflection on slavery and racism in America, and it morphed into something which was less clearly a book for young readers. Though these days, I suppose people of maybe from 9 or 10 and up read Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah. Here's an example of what you call a generation speaking to one another as well, isn't it?
How do you mean?
I mean that here are a couple of books that have been read now for how many years?
Oh, yeah, well, well over 100 years. Yeah. And that's right. And, the humor of Mark Twain has entered the American vernacular. It's become very much part of our common culture. It's funny. I think just as T.S. Eliot once told Groucho Marx that he never wanted to become required reading, I'm sure that Mark mm-hmm. Twain also would have had mixed feelings about knowing that his books are so often required in school, because the fundamental spirit of his books is the spirit of questioning and rebellion and just being a little bit on the edge of what's acceptable.
Yeah. I was always sorry to close that unit, the Mark Twain unit in school when I was a kid. I was like, gee, that was good.
Yeah.
Now, did girls read those books?
I would think so, and it's been sort of the common wisdom within the children's book reviewing community and library world that girls tend to enjoy reading about boy heroes. Boys are less likely to read about girl heroes, though there have been exceptions like Beverly Cleary's books.
Yeah. Have there been many books about good, bad girls?
Well, Harriet the Spy leaps to mind.
Yeah.
That's a book from the early 1960s, and it was, it was embraced by children from the start, but extremely controversial on many counts. Harriet is an 11-year-old girl living in Manhattan. She walks around, sort of skulks around in a sweatshirt with heavy, sort of boyish glasses on. She spies on her neighbors. She is difficult enough in her parents' eyes that her parents decide to take her to a therapist. And you also, incidentally, within the story, but it was a shocking detail to some readers, witness her parents having cocktails in the evening, as if this was going to trigger, a drinking spree on the part of 11-year-olds. The thing about children's books is that they avoid the taboos of their time, or they just gently tap into them in a way that makes them lightning rods for controversy.
Yeah. Where would you put the Nancy Drew books?
Well, they were incredibly popular. The first ones appeared in 1930, again during the Depression. I think they were a great escape to read about this young female character in a roadster who was very self-assured and, you know, leading a very fascinating life of, you know, mystery, crime-solving. And they were published by or created by something called the Stratemeyer Syndicate. Edward Stratemeyer was responsible for many of the most popular children's books of the 20th century, the Hardy Boys, the Bobbsey Twins, the Nancy Drew books, and several other series. These books were inexpensive. They were wildly popular. They were generally adventure stories. Kids loved them. But they were condemned by the library community, from which most of the critics of the early 20th century came, because they were seen as stories that had been whipped out in the literary equivalent of a mass production literary factory, and therefore were not elevating in the way that the librarians, at least of the time, hoped that aesthetically uplifting in the way that librarians hoped children's literature would be. So it's a very good example of a book and a kind of book that that children took to their hearts without having really to stop and think about it, but that well-meaning grown-ups looking on wanted to keep them from.
Yeah, what should children read? Were librarians the first critics of children's literature in America?
Not the first. Interestingly, they claim to be the first. You know, whenever you're in charge, you get to write history for a while. And Children's Service for Library Service for Children began in the U.S. around 1900 and was a wonderful thing in many respects. Librarians were very interested in setting high standards, and they were idealistic people. They had, you know, limitations in taste and judgment, but generally they were aiming to provide a growing nation of children with the chance to better themselves and to learn more about the world and to be exposed to beauty from an early age. And so they not only ran libraries around the country, library children's rooms, but they also participated as reviewers, and they created awards that were given to writers and illustrators and so on. But in the 19th century, you had a scattering, but a significant scattering, of literary people who were not specialists in work with children, who recognized that childhood was an important time of life, and who would sometimes write on a regular basis in the most serious literary magazines like The Nation and The Atlantic Monthly. To me, one of the heroes from that period was a man named Horace Scudder, who was based in Boston. He was the editor of The Atlantic Monthly. He also edited a magazine for children, which had very, very high literary standards. It was kind of the New Yorker for children of its day, the 1860s. And he also was the one who befriended and translated and brought over the work of Hans Christian Andersen for American children. So he saw no division between striving for high standards in literature for adults and doing the same for children. In our time, it's more common for one group, the ones focused on children's books, to be sort of disconnected from the adult world, and the adult world to look down a little bit on what the children's book people are doing.
Hmm.
Became more specialized.
Yeah. What role do children's librarians play today?
Well, they're a valiant and, I think, really wonderful group of people. Since the 70s, I think the library community has been, while still as deeply concerned with high literary standards as their predecessors had been, going back to the turn of the century, I think they've just been a little bit more open-minded and aware that children read books for all sorts of reasons, some of which have to do with literature, but others not. Some children read because they want to know about trucks. Some children read because they want to talk at the water fountain, you know, the equivalent of the office water cooler, with their buddies about the latest Redwall fantasy or the latest Nancy Drew or, you know, Babysitter's Club, whatever popular series they might be reading. And so I think they've been a lot more open in terms of what sorts of children's books they put on their shelves, and more aware of the great range that there is within children in terms of what might be their interests and even more importantly, their needs.
Yeah. How is the children's room of, oh, let's say the early 1900s, how is today's children's department different from the days of the children's room?
Oh, well, that's a good question. In the early days, they had small chairs and small tables. You know, they were aware that the room had to be, you know, designed and furnished to the scale of children. Mm-hmm. So they had that understanding. Very often, the emphasis was on kind of understated grandeur. You know, there'd be wood paneling, and there'd be showcases in which to put rare dolls and maybe examples of original art from children's books in exhibits, and there'd be a story alcove. In some ways, we would recognize the rooms of 100 years ago as very much like the ones we have now. But, of course, we also have new media coming in, DVDs, and before that there were long-playing records of storytellers and music from around the world. And there are a lot more paperbacks in children's libraries today than there were as recently as 30 years ago. That goes back to the old idea that you know that a children's book should be this exquisite aesthetic object mm-hmm. and experience. So for years, librarians were resistant to paperbacks. But then during the 70s, which was an era of high inflation, they had less money to spend on books, and they realized that they could get a lot more books if they open themselves up to paperbacks. So that's another example of how things have become more flexible in recent times. Mm.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. We're talking this afternoon about American children's literature. Our guest is Leonard Marcus. He's the author most recently of Minders of Make-Believe, Idealist Entrepreneurs in the Shaping of American Children's Literature. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, your thoughts about what children should read and children's books. The numbers in the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to join us, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free a toll-free number to talk about books, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon, Leonard Marcus, is a leading historian and critic in the field of American children's literature. He is the author now of 7 books, his latest being Minders of Make-Believe. He is also the author of Margaret Wise Brown, Awakened by the Moon, and Dear Genius, The Letters of Ursula Nordstrom. Again, listeners, your questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. How do today's reviewers of children's literature work? What do they look for? When you look at a new publication for children, or how do you begin to critique it?
First thing to say is there are 8,000 children's books being published in America every year. So it's like a tidal wave. It's amazing how much is being done across the age range, from books for babies on through books for teens. it's kind of overwhelming, and I think nobody would claim to be able to read everything that's published each year. I have an idea. I have strong memories of my own childhood. That's helpful, at least as background. Mm-hmm. I happen to be the father of someone who's now 16, but I paid a lot of attention to him as he was growing up. Those are all useful experiences. But I make the assumption that there ought to be something in most books for children which would also be something that I would respond to even now. So I'm usually looking for some kind of emotional authenticity, some feeling that I can relate to and that I, you know, can believe a child of the age for which the book was written could also relate to. Most children's books are character-driven because that the character at the center becomes the point of identification, mm-hmm. emotionally and otherwise, for the reader. So I'm looking for believable characters, characters with feeling. And these days, so many books that are written for children are striving very hard to be sort of hip in a glib way. So I'm looking for books that go beyond that. I love humor, you know, but I want there to be some heart in a book also.
Yeah. Let's take a call now. A listener in Urbana on line one would like to talk with you.
Hello.
Good afternoon. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi. I just have a comment about something that happened to me many years ago. I was reading to my granddaughter, who was at that time, I suppose, about 4 or 5, a book called The Giving Tree,
uh-huh.
which I thought was a lovely story. But she started to cry. She
uh-huh.
felt very sorry for the tree because it was cut down in the end. And I just wondered if you have any comment about that sort of a response to such a lovely story.
Oh, well, sure. I mean, it is sad. So crying seems to me a very appropriate response. I mean, one of the things to remember about children's books is that it's nice to share them between a child and a parent. If you were there when your child was crying, you know, it becomes a chance to talk about how she feels, and then a chance to sort of talk about other related things too, maybe from, you know, your personal experience. So the experience, the shared experience of a book at home, sort of expands, magnifies the book, makes it more than it is just when it's sitting on the shelf by itself. I also don't think you know, parents should be concerned or even afraid when their children have strong reactions to books. And just the opposite, really. It seems to me that it shows that they're really connecting, and it's touching something really basic inside themselves.
Yes, I felt very guilty about making her cry. But
oh, that's interesting.
Yes, I did at the time. She was my little granddaughter.
Sure. I mean, that's a very human response, but I think it's good to remember these other thoughts, too.
Yes, it is, and of course she's a young woman now, and certainly didn't do her any harm to cry about it,
uh-huh.
an emotional story.
Yeah.
And I've cried about books myself, so
uh-huh. sure.
I just felt bad about it at the time and just wanted to have your comment on
oh,
it.
No, I'm glad you did, because, you know, I think that a lot of parents have reactions of that kind and are generally very sort of nervous around children's books and how children are going to respond to them. And it's good to, I think, remember that kids are generally pretty resilient.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes Bruno Bettelheim wrote about this in his book about fairy tales, The Uses of Enchantment, that sometimes when you read a scary story like Hansel and Gretel to a young child, if that child isn't ready for the darker parts of the story, you know, like when various characters get thrown into ovens, things like that, it's very one way that children deal with that is just to kind of not hear that part.
Oh.
They have ways of protecting themselves or even to rewriting the story in their head in such a way that it becomes more to their more scaled to their level of experience.
Mm. Yes, I remember myself with that story, of course, and when I was small, and I just viewed it as fantasy, and
mm-hmm.
and yeah, it was scary, but I didn't internalize it as, you know,
uh-huh.
something that would happen to me, but
uh-huh.
my granddaughter, apparently, you know, this really affected her, and I just wanted to make that
comment. No, I appreciate it, and also, you know, if you have two children, you could have one react one way and one react the other, and it just shows you how different we are from each other.
Oh, of course. course, of course. I think her sister wouldn't have, just knowing them now, they're young women. Yes, well, thank you for your
program. You made some really interesting points.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. What I remember about Hansel and Gretel was I remember how clever the children were.
Uh-huh.
And I really took comfort from that.
Yeah.
You know, here, we have a scary, scary character. And, you know, when you're a kid, you think that, you know, there's a scary character in the closet or under the bed, you know. But with a story like that, I thought,
Oh, yeah. And it's kind of great that in the beginning, Hansel does all the clever stuff. And in the end, his sister gets to be clever, too.
Yeah. When you were a kid growing up, what were your favorite books?
Ah, well, most of the books that I had were little golden books. They were what most children had in the 1950s. Because most towns around the U.S. didn't have a bookstore, but golden books were sold in unusual places. They were sold in 5 and 10 cent stores, drug stores, and supermarkets. So I had about 20 or 30 of them all lined up on my shelf with the gold spine out, and I used to sort of stare at them when I was 4 or 5 years old and wonder if those spines maybe were real gold. And I kind of hoped they were.
Yeah.
And I can remember really daydreaming over some of those books. There was one about what do you want to be when you grow up?
Uh-huh.
You know, and I would lie on the rug thinking, well, do I want to be a gas station attendant or do I want to be a doctor? unanswerable questions when you're 4 years old.
I remember a series at the library, I want to be.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I want to be a fireman. I want to be a librarian.
Every family gathering, I would brace myself for the uncle or aunt who would ask me that question in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And then a little bit later, I was 10 years old when President Kennedy was elected president, and I'd actually done a little bit of leafleting in my neighborhood for him. And then a young people's edition of Profiles in Courage came out right at the time of the inauguration, and I demanded to my parents that they go get me a copy, and they did. And I think it made a huge impression on me that a president of the United States would write a book for children.
We've got a number of folks who would like to talk with you now. Now we're going to go to a listener on line one in Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a request from a young friend in Nepal whom we were going to see on a trip. She gave me a list of books that she would like to have if I was willing to bring them. One of them was The Invention of Hugo Cabré.
Uh-huh.
And I looked at that at the bookstore, and I thought, my gosh, this is an awfully fat book. Do I want to pack it?
Do you want to pack it? Yeah. That's a good question.
But I looked at it, and I thought, gee, this is going to be very stimulating for not just the reading, but you have to look carefully at. It helps to look interestingly at the pictures.
Uh-huh.
Because it's a mixture of a graphic novel. Would you call it a graphic novel?
It's a hybrid. You're right to say that it's a mixture. It's somewhere between a novel and a graphic novel, leaning strongly in the direction of the latter, because there's so many stretches of 20 or 30 or more pages that are just drawings, and then you get to a little bit of story, a written story, and then you get back into the drawings. Yeah, and it's about the early days of movie making in France.
Yeah. It's about a young boy who is orphaned. His father's a clockmaker,
mm-hmm.
and he gets sort of taken in by a drunken uncle whose job it is to fix the clocks, keep the clocks running in a train station in Paris, and he lives and works behind the walls of the train station. The uncle disappears, and the boy continues the job and tries to survive and develops a sort of a friendship with a young girl. It's sort of a mystery, and I just thought it was fascinating the way the author worked the pictures in the drawings, which are really nicely done, in charcoal or pen and ink. I'm not sure.
Probably charcoal. Yeah, I think that's right.
And so I would think that there would be an opportunity to talk about or to look at how he accomplished the effects. And he does carry the story along in ways that are unusual to me.
Uh-huh.
For instance, he'll start with a distant view.
Yeah.
And then zoom in closer and closer and closer, so you end up focusing on some detail.
Uh-huh.
As each page turns. So it's not simply a each frame is related to the other one in that one is more detailed than the other.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. You know, it's Martin Scorsese, the film director, has optioned that book and apparently is already working on a film based on it. So there'll be chances to see the story in more than one way.
Yeah, very interesting. I haven't seen that book yet. I have to make a point of that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it won this year's Caldecott
right,
Medal, too.
Right, right. And there were cheers that went up. Right at the
Well, it was an unusual choice.
Yeah.
Because most picture books are 32 pages long and look a certain way, whereas this one is about 400 pages long.
Yeah.
And it's just a different kind of book. It's a one of a kind book.
Let's take I want to thank the listener for her contribution.
Yeah.
And I've got three other callers here in line, so let's go next to Morris, Illinois, line 4. Hi.
Hi, I'd like to ask a question, and I'll take my answer on the air. I want to thank you for, this is just a wonderful program, and your guest is just fantastic. What a great listener you are, sir.
Oh, thank you.
Your response to the questions are just wonderful. It's great to hear that, and I hate to be sexist, but from a male, notwithstanding, I'm 50 years old. I am the leader of a very large church congregation. I'm very well read, but I find that probably because I had an extremely rich childhood, very free horses, riding in the river, and just very wild and free, jumping on trains, and then I'd call my parents and they'd come pick me up from towns down the road. And so to this day, my preference is for the teen books. For example, the trilogies such as the Maximum Ride books. I don't know if you're familiar.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And the Pullman books, one of which is the Subtle Knife. And,
yeah.
And I just find them so much more freeing than adult fiction. And you did mention in the beginning that you looked for that authentic quality, that something beyond what's cool and what's popular now. And I was wondering if you would talk about that, the imagination, if it changes much, or if those adults who are still excellent writers of children literature have retained a great imagination that a lot of more mature authors sort of lose. And to me, their books are a little bit predictable and humdrum.
Hmm.
And so I was just wondering if you would comment on the freedom of scope that some of the teen books have that reach out to people like me who love the adventure and the freedom and the out of the box. And I thank you very much for your anticipated response.
Sure. Well, I think if you look at it sort of historically, around in the early 19th century, you know, people were moving to cities. They were modern life was sort of taking shape in various ways, focused around ideas of realism about life, you know, and fairy tales were, it was at that time that fairy tales were sort of set aside just as reading for young children, stories about things that could not be, and adults wanted novels, and the modern novel was born, and it tended to be about characters somewhat like themselves, living in situations more dramatic, but essentially like situations that they themselves could find themselves in. So there was a kind of divide that took place in the book world. Fantasy was kind of written off as childish, and realistic storytelling was thought to be what adults would like. But now we're seeing those lines being crossed again. And interestingly, I think one reason has been because the world has been so violent in modern times.
Mm.
And people like Tolkien, who was a soldier in World War I, saw that science and reason and the realistic outlook produced tremendous destruction as much as it did progress in the world. And he and C.S. Lewis and other writers became more attracted to something which is sometimes called speculative fiction, trying to look beyond the real world and imagine other worlds or other ways that our world might be. And the tremendous Tolkien struck a chord, and his books became very, very popular in the U.S. and England, other parts of the world. and inspired generations of writers since then. Writers like Susan Cooper, Lloyd Alexander, and in more recent times, Philip Pullman, one of the people you mentioned. And I think they're really all about questioning the limits of looking at the world just in terms of, you know, realism, and trying to find other ways of talking about moral issues, and just, you know, opening people's minds up so that they can ask the question, what if, and imagine a world that doesn't have to operate in quite the same way that ours does, with all its flaws.
Let's take another call. Evergreen Park, line 2. Hi.
Well, hello, hello.
Hi.
Yes, am I on?
Yes, you are.
Yeah.
Oh, very good. First of all, kudos to the University of Illinois. Years ago, through a grant, your director of the library was sent to us here in Evergreen Park to help us remodel our library, and today we have a brand spanking new library due to Fred Schliff, the former director of the U of I Library. So thank you. Leonard, question.
Yeah.
Since I'm still on the library board as its vice president, you mentioned of all the books that are sifted through, some 8,000 a year. Are you aware of how that selection process takes place and how it finally gets weeded down to what is on our shelves?
Well, I'm sure different libraries have different ways of doing it. I know that the New York Public Library, for instance, has an internal review process, and before a book will be purchased by the library, one or two staff members will have had to have written reviews, basically, that are then passed around and discussed. So I know that's one way that it happens. Do you want to talk about the way it's done at the university?
Perhaps, and maybe on the macro level of we'll just say twice that many.
Mm-hmm.
Hit the mark.
I mean, another mechanism that I know is made use of by lots of libraries around the country are the professional review journals like Booklist and Library Journal and School Library Journal, which sometimes will star a book when they review it if they think it's particularly good. And some librarians, in a somewhat mechanical way, will purchase a book only if it got at least 2 stars in the 4 or 5 professional journals that they read on a regular basis. So that's another way of helping librarians make those choices.
Are you comfortable with that process?
No. I mean, I mean, ideally, I think librarians would actually have read the book before they decide yes or no. In the old days, when there were fewer books, that was a lot easier. So you can understand why they have to resort to these more secondhand methods. You know, and with the internet, there's a lot of discussion that goes on about books, and I think that's probably a useful tool now for people who are making those decisions too.
Do you have any thoughts to some of the controversial books and subjects that are trying to make its way to children, i.e., The Two Princes?
I'm sorry, which one?
The Two Princes, about two young men who...
Oh, I don't know that book per se, I mean, but there certainly have been other books, like Heather Has Two Mommies, for instance, which was...
Okay.
Okay. A book about a lesbian family. Personally, I think those books have a place in the library, and every community is different, and I think the librarians tend to know their community, and it's possible to have a book and not have it be, you know, on a table that a 4-year-old can reach for it without the supervision of a parent, if that seems like, you know, the best option in that particular community. But, you know, in general, I think it's a better thing for people to have, as wide a range of books available to them as possible.
I didn't mean to stump you with that question. It certainly is an interesting topic of our times, of what is applicable and palatable for...
Right. And it varies, you know, from generation to generation, and I think it varies from community to community also within a given time. It's in a way, the question. You know, some of Judy Blume's novels for middle grade and teen kids have been major focuses of censorship, if you want to call it that, or objections from various parents who were concerned that she was, you know, talking about sexuality in a way that made the parent feel uncomfortable. And I mean, that's, I guess, one of the main subject that she sometimes censored because of. But, you know, over the years, those books haven't ruined any lives that I'm aware of, and many, many children have embraced them as the only way to find out about things that they desperately wanted to understand. So, you know, I would hope, and I'm just sort of speaking for myself, that people who are inclined to ban books would maybe at least step back and try to imagine that there might be another side to the story.
Mm-hmm. There, we've got to leave it. We've got to wrap up here. We're out of time. Leonard Marcus, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, it's been really interesting, and I'm glad people called.
Yeah, and I hope that maybe we'll have you on again in the future. We can talk some more about history and talk some more about contemporary children's literature.
Oh, thanks. I'd really love to do that.
That would
sure.
be terrific.
Yeah.
We'll keep you in the Rolodex, as they say.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Leonard Marcus is the author of 7 books, the most recent, Minders of Make-Believe, Idealists, Entrepreneurs, and the Shaping of American Children's Literature. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin.